Well, welcome everybody. I want to thank you for coming for the session on peer-run organizations and the Affordable Care Act. And I'm Phil Leaf. I'm going to be the moderator of the session today. And speakers, Dan Fisher, who's the Executive Director of the National Empowerment Center, which is one of the three SAMHSA-funded consumer TA centers. He's a PhD in biochemistry and also an MD, who did a psychiatry residence in the at the Harvard Medical School. And he's going to be the first speaker, and then he's going to step out because his wife, Tish Davis, is receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Occupational Health and Safety Center, the Alice Hamilton Award for Lifetime Achievement. So hopefully he's going to be able to support her during that award and then come back for some of the discussions. Our second speaker is going to be Richard Frank, who's currently a professor at the Harvard Medical School's Department of Healthcare Policy. As many of you know, he's done extensive research on the economics of mental health, substance abuse care, long-term care financing, and disability policy. And from 2009 to 2011, he served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And hopefully he will soon be also returning to Washington. For more than just a visit for a couple of days. Our third speaker is going to be Alicia Ostrow, who's a doctoral candidate in our Department of Mental Health at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And her dissertation actually serves the basis for today's discussion. As a biased faculty advisor, I think it's a great dissertation, and it's really been nice to be able to work with someone who only periodically has to ask you questions. She's really conducted this research almost entirely, both by herself, but also bringing in colleagues and other things, really bringing in a group of collaborators to develop the program. And so if any of you happen to know of jobs after people get their degrees, I can give you a very strong recommendation. And then our final speaker is going to be Sarah Dave Dow, who's the director of Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Center, and that includes a peer-run respite program, AFIA. And she's also active in Hearing Voices USA, which is a movement to provide mutual support to people who hear voices and experience extreme states, as well as other state and national activism activities. And so I think you'll see we have a really nice mix of advocates and researchers and researcher advocates and advocate researchers. And Dan? Well, let me just give you a little bit of overview. So just for the peer support, it's, as many of you know, it's an important component in the continuum of care for individuals diagnosed with mental disorders. And peer-run mental health programs have really been both been shown to be effective in supporting people in recovery, as well as sort of just creating at the forefront strategies that really need to be much more widely in incorporated into all our sort of care. And then both in traditional settings and as independent peer organizations, these evidence-based practices have been shown to meet the highest standards both by SAMHSA and CMS. The policy motivation for today's panel is, as some of you in the room know, there's the Affordable Care Act. But at the same time, we are also having major changes in block grants and funding of behavioral health services through mental health and substance use. Many states have or are in the process of integrating these things. And so we're at a period where there's a huge amount of change going on in our healthcare services. And wraparound and support services have sort of been shoehorned into the medical treatment model because we're talking about a lot of what is driving is people didn't have funds to get services and care. And so we're trying to allow for those kind of things, facilitate those kind of things, but at the same time we have a lot of different organizational settings and strategies, all of which weren't necessarily based on a funding of professionals to deliver services. And so how we evolve a more effective way of paying for services and at the same time not lose some of the benefits and really very effective services we have is one of the policy things that we're going to be talking about today. And it not just relates a whole range of these services, both the wellness recovery action planning, the RAP services, the employment and other kind of things, which we've developed and often funded out of our block grants or our systems of care, but they clearly aren't medical services, even if they are targeted to people who meet a criteria. So how, as we're moving into a medical financing framework or health financing framework, and we have these other things, how is that going to do that? And then likewise, the research questions are the Affordable Care Act, peer supports, this survey, which the thinking of it began probably at the same time people were just starting to think about the Affordable Care Act, was, you know, getting a baseline information on, well, what are these peer-run organizations? What are they doing now? How are they funding themselves? Both, what are their feelings about being able to participate in the Affordable Care Act and these changes in the states, as well as potentially having some very important baseline data to see how they both fare. And the criteria that was being used in the study for peer-run organizations, peer-operated programs, was developed by a consensus panel, and some of the people on this panel were participants in the consensus panel. So either have, you know, they have may have an incorporated independent not-for-profit board, or the board of directors or advisory boards, at least 51% peers, consumers, survivors, ex-patients, are in a parent organization, because some of these may not be incorporated themselves, but part of a larger incorporated entity that meets those same criteria. The director being a peer, consumer, survivor, ex-patient, or the majority of the staff members also. So we'll now have Dan come up and talk. And
thank you, Philip, and thank you, everyone, for being here. In a short period, I've been given a large order to summarize our movement, CSX, consumer, survivor, ex-patient, and actually we don't like any of those terms anymore. We prefer people lived experience at this moment. I think the problem is, as long as there are such inequities in power and status, by getting labeled, it almost doesn't matter what your name, you're still going to experience a diminution of your own decision making. And I'm not sure that Phil put into my CV the part actually that I'm probably most proud of in many ways, and that is that I recovered from what was described as schizophrenia, and that's probably been the biggest teacher of my life. And certainly been one of the biggest motivators for my involvement in this CSX movement. So I'll give you just my own sort of involvement in a nutshell. I was hospitalized on several occasions in the 70s, and during the second hospitalization, I was trapped in seclusion. It's really solitary confinement, we get right down to it. And all I could think of was, this should never happen to anyone, anywhere. It's the worst kind of way to treat somebody who's feeling isolated and feeling disempowered, to put them into a locked room and not tell them when or how they'll get out. And I literally started to pass out. Just before I passed out, I had two thoughts. One was, I'm going to become a psychiatrist and unlock all these doors, so that all treatment will be voluntary. And the second thought I had actually was an image. I saw myself in the form of a bluebird fly out the window to safety. I've been working on the first one and trying to recapture the bluebird ever since. And so this movement, I decided to go to medical school and become a psychiatrist, but I realized I needed a counterbalancing training. And that was through the early consumer survivor movement. And I chose my residency in Boston, not because it was an eminent medical school there, but because the Mental Patient Liberation Front was there. So I knew that I needed that training at night in order to counterbalance the training that I was being taught by day. This movement has had a lot of heroes, and I feel as though I stand upon their shoulders. Let's see if I can move this forward. I'm a Mac person, so I don't really know what I'm going to push. Maybe push that. How about that? Here are some of our leaders. Judy Chamberlain was my mentor, the late Judy Chamberlain, and a number of other leaders. We're all aging, and this is a problem in our movement. And we've had trouble, although we have Leisha and Sarah here, the next generation, luckily. But partly, we just have to get out of the way. But we're not sure we trust the next generation. So we're sort of in a betwixt and between situation. Here's another one of our early leaders, Howie the Harp, who single-handedly started three very important self-help groups, two on the coast, California and Portland, Oregon, and one in New York City, and died at the age of 42. He laid down, his quote was, "We want as full possible control over our own lives. Is that too much to ask?" Can't read it very well, it's in yellow. Our movement values have remained very steadfast. We want control over our lives, we want choice, we want self-determination, we want empowerment, we want recovery. So I helped start with Judy Chamberlain and Pat Deegan, the National Empowerment Center, and then we also started National Coalition of Mental Health Recovery, which is really a countrywide organization to change policy in Washington. We have to be on a par with NAMI and with the others. We've now joined with other disability groups and formed the National Disability Leadership Alliance, NDLA. It's 14 groups, national disability groups, all run by people with disabilities, because we want our voice to be represented. This is the logos for five federally funded through SAMHSA technical assistance centers. We're one of them. The other two that are consumer survivor run are PeerLink and the Self-Help Clearinghouse, and there are two that are consumer supporters. And that's the STAR Center and CAFE Center. So what I wanted to go over quickly a bit was, we've established through another group called NAPS, National Association of Peer Specialists, National Ethical Standards for Peer Support. And these are hard to maintain, as you'll hear the other speakers go into. In order to fit, and actually Philip referred to this, in order to fit the, as he said, shoehorn into the reimbursement mechanism, we have to meet medical criteria. And there are a number of changes that need to be made in Medicaid in order to actually have reimbursement be more of a reality. One is to change medical necessity, so it includes recovery. I won't go into the rest, I think the speakers will. But I will go over these standards because I'll show how each one of them has a challenge involved when it comes to people working in the system. So I was on the New Freedom Commission, I was a member, and we got recovery as a cornerstone of the transformation to a new system, and we said peers will play a very important role. Well, the states picked up on peers, but they didn't pick up on recovery very well. And you really can't hire peers and have the same old system. And that's what we're facing, unfortunately. So we need a system that makes it safe for peers to work. And that means a system that allows peers to be empathetic and connect on an emotional level. That's discouraged, of course, clinically. To be respectful of each person having an important and unique contribution to the world. And someone's labeled mental illness, they're told they don't have a contribution to the world. Defend human rights. The human rights violations are rampant within our system. There's very little due process. All you have to do is be hospitalized once and you realize you don't know when you're going to get out, how you're going to get out, and a lawyer really can't practice law in mental health because there is no coverage of the Constitution once you're labeled with mental illness. Basically, you're no longer covered by the Constitution. And peers want to be honest and direct, clear communication, but that's discouraged often in the system. Peer support, there's a lot of emphasis on mutuality, and this is very important, that peer support remains mutual as possible. When one person's paid and the other person isn't, it's hard to have mutuality. And recovery support is strength-focused. Unfortunately, our system emphasizes pathology, says that everyone is broken. Our belief is everyone's whole, that they've experienced trauma, the trauma of life, the trauma of development, the trauma of their economy, the trauma, unfortunately, of being labeled. So you have to recover not only from the stress that put you in there, but also from the system itself. And then peer support wants to, we want to be transparent, and often that means explaining things in very clear, down-to-earth terms, which is, of course, hard, and our system is very mystified, and we want it to be person-driven and voluntary. I want to, at the end, spend a little bit of time on what I believe is one way to transform the system quietly, secretly. I was talking to Ms. Mary Jane last night about this emotional CPR. I said, I think that it is one of the ways to change the system without the system knowing it's being changed. And she said that may be the only way the system could be changed without knowing that it's being changed. Because resistance comes up very quickly as soon as you say you're going in and you're going to, you know, change the system, and people get very defensive. So instead, our goal here is to just bring in our values through a very practical way of people helping people. And this is not just mental health. This is for anyone to help another person, just like CPR helps people's physical heart. This is emotional CPR to help people's emotional heart. And this is a very quick sort of comparison of the emotional CPR approach compared to the traditional clinical approach. So the values of emotional CPR are the values of recovery and of our movement, but we don't say that too loudly. Just for those peers grasp this immediately, but non-peers are a little bit uncomfortable. They prefer people to continue with the diagnostic system. So we encourage people to show their emotions. It's not only okay, but actually the training of not showing your feelings probably interferes with people's recovery. That power with is much more important than power over, and that sharing your life experience actually makes you human, and being human is a way to connect with people. And this next one, it's interesting, you sort of write things down and then you understand later what you mean. Just like say things, and what did I mean by that? And there's an approach, open dialogue, actually out of Finland that really emphasizes learning what you're trying to say. And that means often repeating it. So suspending your belief is very important, your own belief. And that's actually suspending your own culture, your own biases, your own stereotypes. And because we practice basically through the traditional clinical approach and a kind of imperialism. We think we know what the right culture is. And so our system, I think, tends to be intrinsically culturally incompetent, because it's reinforcing one culture over another. So we avoid labels, and our training is really not a therapeutic training. It's really an untraining so people can be themselves, and it's very accessible. And I don't want to be overly critical of mental health first aid, and in many ways I'm very grateful, because it actually was our impetus in creating this, was we were so disappointed in mental health first aid, which basically reinforces the system as we know it. But we're now trying to work out a sort of a collaborative approach that for some people, maybe they can start with mental health first aid, then they can learn emotional CPR, because this is very hands-on, very much role-playing. A lot of people aren't quite ready for that at first, but they might, after they take mental health first aid, they might be able to do this. So thank you all very much. And there's some materials in the back if you're interested. I'll put a few of our workbooks, and the first 8 people that come can just pick up their own workbook for free. Otherwise, you have to go to our website and order one, emotional-cpr.org. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's kind of refreshing for an academic to be talking about peer supports. For those of you who are a member of the same tribe, will know that we have peer review and we have peer disputes, but we came up a little thinner on peer supports. And so anyhow, so it's kind of fun to talk about this. Now, the Affordable Care Act encourages the use of evidence-based peer supports for people with severe and persistent mental disorders in a variety of ways. Some of the ways are explicit in that you can look at regulations and service packages and things and see the words peer support or peer run counseling or things like that. Others are more implicit, where the incentives and the performance that an organization is supposed to pursue lead you in a fairly a significant way towards peer support services. And I'm going to try to talk a little bit about each of those with some examples. But I guess first and foremost, if you just look at the Affordable Care Act and you ask sort of what's the big deal here, you know, obviously the biggest deal is the Medicaid expansion in this area. And at the latest count, it seems to be around 27 states are going ahead with expansion. And in that, there are a variety of sort of baseline packages that are being set up. And so one chunk of states are essentially taking their state plans and expanding them and tweaking them a little bit so that they conform with the directives about what essential health benefits have to look like they have to be at parity. Most state plans are not at parity, but they're tweaking those so that they will become at parity. Another set of benchmarks are the so-called three Deficit Reduction Act benchmark plans, which are the Blue Cross Standard Plan for the federal employees, the largest HMO package in the state, and the largest state employees plan. So that would be a second batch. And then the third batch is a secretarial approved plan. And their states can be sort of creative. And there are states doing all three of those. So let me talk about the two mechanisms that I think are what I call explicit in terms of their promotion of peer support. The first is the Medicaid 1959 state plan option, and the other one is the Medicaid Health Homes. And I want to illustrate how I'll illustrate the more implicit approach by discussing sort of some of the new approaches to integration that are being taken. So let me first start with the 1959. 1959 has been around for a long time, and it has always offered increased flexibility, increased ability to develop new evidence-based services for people with disabilities, and of particular interest have been so-called recovery supports and supported employments have been two of the sort of most significant for the behavioral health community. And what is different in the what was passed in the Affordable Care Act is that now you can put those services into place and those options into place without having to show budget neutrality by doing a state plan option. And so that changes, that's a huge impediment that's taken away. And so what there are sort of three key features of the 1959 that are worth noting. The first is that there's an ability to target specific populations. So you don't have to target all Medicaid enrollees. You don't have to target all disabled Medicaid enrollees. You can target a specific population, like people with severe and persistent mental illnesses. The second thing that it offers is a very flexible service package and also a richer set of optional services, two of which are, as I mentioned, supported employment and recovery supports. And so, as I said, the key here is that you don't need to meet the budget neutrality requirements anymore. And you also, just to emphasize, you do not have to expand your Medicaid program to do this. So, for example, Louisiana has adopted 1959, but they are not expanding their Medicaid program, as everybody has no doubt heard millions of times. The state of Wisconsin is including peer supports as part of a package of community recovery support services. So that's an example. Other states are doing that as well. Okay? So that's thing one. And so very clearly, in those instances, states, as they sort of craft these more flexible services, they take the guidance, the general guidance in Medicaid for what a peer support program and peer support services are, and they can then apply them as either optional services or part of a larger package. The second explicit area is the Medicaid health home, and that's the second mechanism. Now, health homes are really aimed at improving integration and coordination of services for adults with multiple chronic conditions and or a severe and persistent mental illness. So in a sense, you're not supposed to be served by these new institutions unless you either have multiple chronic medical conditions or severe and persistent mental illness or some other form of substance use problem or mental health problem that comes along with another medical condition. Now, the health homes are there really to emphasize one-stop shopping for addressing complex medical, behavioral health, and long-term services needs. And what both of these options that I'm talking about do is they, more than Medicaid even usually does, they sort of erase the boundary or fuzzy the boundary between traditional health care and long-term services and supports and human services. Now, to do so, what health homes, to sort of do this, accomplish this one-stop shopping, health homes typically involve care management delivered usually by teams, self-management support, individual family support, and referral to community and support services. And peer supports are recognized as an evidence-based ingredient in both the care management and the self-management pieces. And a variety of the states who are adopting those have sort of integrated them. As I mentioned, there's recent guidance from CMS that highlights the recognition of community supports that updates some 2007 guidance. These were put out in May of 2013. And several states have already sort of started to put peer supports services to work in the implementation of their health homes, in particular Rhode Island, New York, and Ohio. Okay, now let me turn to the more general implicit way of encouraging peer support. The first is there's a general philosophy in the Affordable Care Act, which is to try to put more and more services into the hands of organizations that are clinical, or at least have a lot of clinical capabilities over a broad array of potential needs of the population, and to put that under a budget. Okay? And so this is the step away from fee-for-service. So when you look at ACOs, health homes, patient-centered medical homes, bundling of services, all of those are steps in the direction of putting more services under the control of sort of more broad-based clinical organizations under a budget. And so what that does, in addition, is it also comes with the idea of shared savings. That is that there's a partnership either between the federal government and the state government and a provider, or between state, federal, provider, and an insurer, where what happens is when there are efficiencies that are realized, they get split up between each of the parties. And usually it's in some proportion according to what they were on the hook for originally. So if it's Medicaid, on average it's 50-50 for the states. If it's dual eligibles, it's usually something like 25% for the state, 75% for the federal government, things like that. And so this general approach creates pretty strong incentives for organizations to look to save money, and where they look is for the most high-cost, complicated cases, and to do a better job managing them because in fact that's where the potential savings lie, and they want to do so in a way that is most cost effective. And I think there's now a solid basis of evidence to say that if you want to save on emergency room, hospital-based, and other forms of institutional care, one way of doing that pretty cost-effectively is to put peer supports into the mix of both the care management teams, but also self-management and community support functions. And so in this sense, peer supports are attractive, and what you're seeing is some of the ACOs that are now specializing more in the sickest populations are tending to start to integrate peer supports into this. We see that also happening on the dual eligibles. 19 states are implementing coordinated care arrangements under demonstration authority from CMS. A number of these are focused, I think 7 are focused specifically on people with severe and persistent mental illnesses. And what you see is several of them are incorporating peer supports into particularly the care management teams and the self-management support functions. So what you see, I think, is that there are the thing that's driving this is both sort of new institutions and new benefits, but also new payment arrangements. And those, even though those are to be celebrated, they also come with threats. Because, in fact, history tells us that when you integrate care and when you coordinate care across a broad range of populations, and you put high-powered incentives into place, unless you can really keep track of what is being done and what the performance is, people with behavioral health problems often get the short end of the stick. It's akin to the thing that we all grew up with, which is when a big guy and a little guy have a fight, the little guy usually loses. Well, that's sort of what's at work here. And so what I think is very important for addressing these threats in the context of both the new institutions but the new payment arrangements is having a set of performance measures that keep track of when bad things start to happen. Now, and I'm not talking about sort of optimizing, you know, what is the ideal measure for performance and outcome. I'm at this point just pointing to the idea that what we want to know is when people are cutting corners at the expense of the sickest people and the most disabled populations, you want to be able to track it and track it quickly and then be able to act on it. So I think I'll stop there and turn it over to Lynn.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming, and thanks to all the panelists for joining me here as well. As Phil said, I'm going to be talking about some of the results of my dissertation, which was a national survey of peer-run organizations, and I'm just going to be talking about the results related to willingness to be a Medicaid provider. So Phil sort of described the data collection. It was web-based, and then from the people who responded, we had an 80% response rate. After cleaning for our definition of peer-run, there are 380 observations in the data set, and 350 of those reported that they provide direct support, and I'm going to be specifically talking about those ones today. So the majority, so 77%, vast majority, are getting the majority of their funding from government sources, and only 13% are getting the majority from private sources. So they're already... The financial sustainability is already based on government mechanisms. However, those are different at this time than what we're discussing here, which is, you know, Medicaid expansion and other financing mechanisms associated with the Affordable Care Act. So they were asked whether they receive funding from these sources or not. It doesn't indicate the amount of their budget that is from those sources. So the most frequent source of support was from donations, but after that is state funding. And as everybody may know or not, Medicaid is a federal-state partnership. And then the federal sources are actually much lower at about a little over 30%. But you can see they're getting money from a variety of different sources, piecing together enough to stay in operation and support people. But if, you know, look, again, a very small amount of that, just over 10%, is from member dues themselves paying. So this slide, this is not all the things that they reported, the supports and activities that they are engaged in, but I wanted to highlight here some of the things that might be more of a conflict for Medicaid funding and other financing mechanisms. So one important thing is that close to 100% do some kind of advocacy activity. There are various different kinds of advocacy activities included in there. You know, community outreach was one of the most popular, but you know, in that sense, probably not much of a conflict with Medicaid funding, but you know, letter writing to you know, support policy change, participating on committees, demonstrations and protests, all of these things could kind of be in conflict with, you know, continuing to do advocacy and receiving Medicaid funding for a quote unquote medical service. Again, as we sort of talked about at the Phil talked about at the beginning, you know, self-care and wellness activities, mutual support groups, RAP, you know, employment supports, warm lines, legal assistance, these are not medical services. And, you know, a vast number of them are providing these supports to people, which are necessary, but, you know, don't fit into a traditional rubric of, you know, medication management or even case management or ACT teams. So the outcome here that I looked at using a multinomial logistic regression was willingness to accept Medicaid. Based on the hypothesis that would probably be, you know, if people knew more about the ACA, you know, and had discussed healthcare reform with other people and knew about Medicaid expansion, they may be more willing to accept Medicaid. Although it's sort of it's one of those hypotheses you don't really believe in, because if you know, and the more you know about the ACA, probably the more you hate it. In addition to not including the ones that did not report providing direct supports, the ones who reported that they were already a Medicaid provider, which was 30 of them, and some of those are cross-disability organizations or very large peer-run organizations, that they were not included in these analyses. So the question asked, are you willing to become a Medicaid provider, which was defined as a provider organization that bills Medicaid for reimbursement. So 34% said that they were willing, but they had concerns. 28%, so pretty close to that, just said no. 22% said that they didn't know if they were willing or not. And only 16% said, yes, we're willing, no concerns. They were asked how much they know about the Affordable Care Act. It's pretty normally distributed. That 1% of people who know everything about the ACA, they're also looking for jobs, maybe Richard could hire them. There was 24% said that they know nothing. So there are a fair amount of people who know nothing, who reported they know nothing or little about the Affordable Care Act, and then, you know, many more in the middle saying they knew some things. Over 50% had discussed healthcare reform, and this was asked more generally, not in terms of the Affordable Care Act itself. Within the organization, a little over 40% had discussed it within the statewide consumer network, and under 30% had discussed it with the government or a government committee. And about the same number didn't know if anyone had been discussing healthcare reform with anyone. 52% is about half. Knew of plans to expand Medicaid coverage. The data collection was last summer, from April to October of 2012. Right in the middle of that, there was the Supreme Court case people may have heard of, which put the Affordable Care Act on the news. So I was a little concerned about that, but it seems to me that it was fairly balanced and accurate. So I'm not showing the results of the regression because they were not significant. Knowledge of the ACA, Medicaid expansion, discussions with others about healthcare reform were not significantly associated with willingness to be a Medicaid provider. In separate regressions, knowledge of the ACA was associated with having discussed healthcare reform. So people, naturally, who had discussed healthcare reform with others knew more about, reported that they knew more about the ACA. Of those who said that they were not willing or were willing but they had concerns or didn't know if they were willing, they were asked what their concerns were, and they were given a choice of 10 different reasons and then some free text, which has yet to be analyzed but will be. So they're asked on a scale of, you know, if, you know, is this a big concern, or it's a big problem, a small problem, or not a problem, or if they didn't know that it was a problem. So they're ordered here from the biggest big problems. So at the top of that list is conforming to a medical model. I don't get into it in this presentation. There's another question about willingness to be part of a health home, which Richard had talked about as kind of another financing mechanism for incorporating peer-run organizations into insurance expansion and the medical or social care system. And many of the concerns there, that working with providers in a health home would force them to conform to a medical model, and you see that mirrored here. In addition to detracting from their mission of being advocates, so as I said, you know, over close to 100% are doing advocacy. You know, they're concerned that taking Medicaid reimbursement is detracting from part of that mission, which is such a central part of the organizations and what they do. That makes a lot of sense. The concerns that, you know, they're more practical, like having the financial staff to manage the billing, keeping records, you know, quality and performance management, they're kind of fall over the place. I guess financial staff is sort of at the top of the big concerns. The medical necessity criteria, again, could be a huge problem. There's not people who are providing mutual support are not trained in and potentially not interested in giving people diagnoses or labels or documenting medical necessity. It's just not part of the intervention itself. So in conclusion, organizations had both philosophical and practical concerns about Medicaid reimbursement. Education about the ACA is not changing that. You know, SAMHSA has had several rounds of grants now to peer-run organizations to educate people about the ACA and healthcare reform. I think, in general, those are targeted at, you know, teaching individuals that they will be eligible for insurance coverage. At the same time, they have the effect of kind of having statewide networks where people are working together to learn more about the ACA so that they can teach it to other individuals and organizations. I hope that it helps people get insurance coverage, but it's not changing attitudes about their own supports that they're providing and being reimbursed by Medicaid, perhaps because of the actual concerns. So I think it's probably more important at this point to change the aspects of Medicaid reimbursement that the organizations are concerned about, if we want them to be sustainable in the current and future environment. And as I said, there's another aim on willingness to be part of a health home. This is a little bit more positive than attitudes towards Medicaid, but still a lot of concerns about conforming to a medical model, forced and coerced care, you know, power structures within health homes between, you know, peer supporters and doctors. Some stuff that's, you know, for those of us who are in this field every day, all day, even when we're sleeping, it's kind of obvious. The aim of this project was to document this stuff in real life and not just my assumptions or, you know, the people that I know, but really get a population measure of what people really think, independent of the conversations we have with each other. So Sarah is going to comment from the perspective on the ground.
So I want to say, I guess I want to start off by saying, so Alicia talked a lot about forcing services being forced or supports being forced into this medical model system and that being a fear. And I want to say one of the fears is not just these systems and supports, but our lives. And I'm not going to share my story here. I do that in a lot of places, but I am going to share a piece just like Dan did. And that's to say, for those of you, if you have any experience in the mental health system, either professionally or personally, you probably know that there's this experience of developing sort of this tail of diagnoses. And it just sort of continues. You go to different doctors, you get different diagnoses, and it can grow and grow and grow. And I can tell you that when I was in my early 20s. I had gotten a tale of about 4 diagnoses, and it was after a woman sat there with a book on her face, a medical book, a diagnostic book, asking me a bunch of questions about how often I drank, how often I hurt myself, how often I did all these different things, that she started rattling off that I was major depression, and I was generalized anxiety disorder, and I was bulimia, and I was borderline personality disorder. And it was a real changing point in my life, because it was the point I stopped trusting the system. But they actually had decided at that point that they knew who I was based on what they evaluated as symptoms, what they thought they meant, and what they thought they therefore needed to do with me. And so that ended up leading to my first involuntary hospitalization, because I was cutting and burning and I had these diagnoses. And that's what you do with people who have these diagnoses and are doing these things that the system tends to find fairly scary. And what was remarkable to me in that experience, and for years before and after, is that no one actually asked me why I was doing any of those things. They were looking at what the book said, what the best practice was, and therefore what they should do with me. So I went through this hospitalization, and no one asked me why I was cutting and burning. And they missed learning about me, that I was the survivor of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, and that I had real reasons I could describe about why I was doing these things. So our whole lives, this is coming from a whole history of our lives, not just these supports being forced into symptoms. And so this is really, really important. And I want to believe that it's changed, that all this stuff that we're talking about doesn't mean that it's not changed or that it's potentially getting worse. But I can tell you, you know, I went to this diagnostic statistical manual number 5 training recently, not because I care about the book too much, I have to be clear, but because I wanted to know what they were teaching people. And I thought it was great that this medical director was teaching people up there and saying, we are realizing that we have to treat this book for what it is, and that people are not diagnoses. We're not treating these diagnoses. And I thought, yes. And then he followed that up with, we're treating symptoms. I said, no. No. So we have to keep pushing this further. And I don't come from a place of knowing a ton about this. I'm not sure where I would have fit in that pie graph, not in the expert zone for sure. But I'm going to speak to it from where I can, which is this Western Mass Recovery Learning Community. In addition to my personal experience, I've been a part of this since it was born. And we have these 4 arms. So I'm just going to be real brief here, but we have handouts. And I should say, please take the handouts, at least so I don't have to carry them home. There's some up front and some in back. But we have these 4 arms that we do our work in, and they include consultation and learning opportunities. They include individual and group peer-to-peer supports, so things like alternatives to suicide groups and hearing voices groups. We have a 24/7 respite house called AFIA that is an alternative to the hospital, frankly, for people who really find the hospital to be really disruptive to their lives. It can be a place that they can go and spend some time that's hopefully healing and helps them move forward. Alternative healing practices, free access to acupuncture and yoga and all sorts of different things. And that advocacy piece that Laisha mentioned, we do a lot around advocacy. Some of it's legislative. I mean, we can't do like super direct legislative kind of things because of our funding, but we were at the outpatient commitment hearing that was happening in Boston a week or two ago, and we do individual advocacy, and we do a lot of pieces, and our material will tell you more. But I just want to say we're really broad. We're really out there doing a lot of work that I feel would be greatly impacted if our funding was different. And briefly, what our funding is, we get private foundation grants, we get donations, we get city block grants, we get state cost reimbursement, so that's DMH, the Department of Mental Health. We have subcontracts with some providers, co-sponsorships. Basically, they give us money so we can do what we want to do. And so, for instance, our alternatives to suicide groups get funding from a public health organization called Tapestry, and so we're in control of what we're doing with that money. The one that puzzle piece I don't have up here now, which is really growing for us, is people nationally are starting to pay us for some of the trainings that we offer around alternatives to suicide and hearing voices and a number of other things. So just to give you an idea where we're coming from, but I want to be clear that when you look at our funding, part of where we're coming from is a place of what funding will we and will we not accept because of how it's going to impact what we offer and how we offer it. The funding that we have accepted does not require any sort of diagnostic criteria, does not have assessments, does not require us to take notes, does not require us to do intakes, any of these things. You start to see a couple of things down at the bottom with the respite house. we do this, like, incredibly, frankly, if somebody wants to put something on this one sheet they have, they can, and if they don't, they don't, and that's kind of our version of appeasing our funder on wanting to have asked people this question on what's their hope in staying here. So that's maybe our only exception in terms of any sort of note keeping, and frankly, we put right at the bottom of the form that this is, you know, is something our funders asked us to do, and we don't really want to be doing it, and, you know, don't do it if you don't want to. So that's the only give we've had. You just see, this is so important to who we are, because peer is not an identity. It's not a, oh, yes, I've been psychiatrically diagnosed and hospitalized, so I'm a peer. You hear people talking about it, that a lot. That's not what it is. Peer is a way of being with other people. And if you allow funding sources to come in and dictate how you are with other people, then it's no longer a peer-to-peer relationship. And so that's what we're worried about. I want to say our funding, in the face of all this talk about everything's changing, your funding's going to go down, something's going to change, you need to give in, our funding started in 2007 at $350,000. We're over $1 million as of this year. And so I stand here not as an expert about some of the changes that are happening, but I stand here being able to tell you that we keep growing and we are not Medicaid reimbursable. We are not doing these things. I want to say, Laisha mentioned, and I think Dan had mentioned, some of the kinds of things that do get force-fit into the medical model. One of them is RAP. I just want to point out, because it's really important that you know what happens when some of this gets force-fit. I went and visited the respite house in Maine that is supposedly peer-run, and they had a newsletter. And the newsletter said, we have RAP classes, and all you need to do to go do the RAP class is talk to your case manager and get it written into your treatment plan. Now, that might not seem like that big of a deal to you, but for people who have been in the system, who want freedom of choice, who want to own the things they're choosing to do, with something like Wellness Recovery Action Planning that says in its very most basic ethics and founding values, it cannot be forced, it cannot be written into treatment plans, to have that happen because of Medicaid reimbursement, and that's what it came down to. It could not be funded through Medicaid unless it was written into the treatment plan. That was a big deal for a lot of people. There are many people in our community, often the people who get referred to as treatment-resistant or non-compliant or what have you, who will go and get involved with communities if it's truly their choice and isn't getting documented and reported back to some big team somewhere, and who will turn away from things the moment you start saying, like, go talk to your case manager, it has to be written in your treatment plan. It's just the way it works, and I think if you think about your life and if people were hovering over you in that way when you were contemplating any sort of change or choice you wanted to make, it starts to make some sense. So I guess I come from this place of saying, is it worth it? Yeah, it's great to talk about expanding something that we think is really awesome, and I do think there's such power in these peer-to-peer communities, but if these peer-to-peer communities become something totally different, then is it worth it? I can tell you right now, something like the Hearing Voices work that we do, if it became Medicaid reimbursable and we had to track names, there are people I know who never would have entered those rooms. Is it worth it? I don't think it is, because there's a woman I can think of right now who told us she came and hung out, didn't talk to anyone for almost a year because she'd been so hurt by the mental health system and didn't trust it, and started coming here because she didn't have to be reported on who she was and it didn't have to be in a treatment plan. And she's now someone who's doing national trainings with us, and she's come to such a different place in her life. And I don't think it would be worth it just to get some extra funding to change the very foundation of what made that work for her and so many other people in our community. So I think everyone in here, maybe just about as old enough to remember the whole Y2K craze. I know I was in my mid-20s at the time, and I remember everyone was like freaking out for a whole year, like midnight. Like, I was working in a residential program, actually, in a clinical role, actually, and the director was supposed to get the shift covered by someone else, but that person was too scared to work the overnight when it was going to change to midnight because they had to be home with their family in case something was going to happen with Y2K. I kind of feel the same way about some of these meetings, to tell you the truth, that are happening. I get notices every day. You have to come meet and be a part of the dual eligibility conversation. You have to find out what's happening. Everything's going to change. You're going to hit a wall. And you know what? Maybe at some point, our funding is not going to keep growing if we don't get on this train somehow. But so far, it just hasn't happened. And I feel like we're, although things are changing, I don't think we need to give up our values and just run and leap onto these trains just to get there. And I can just offer just a couple more examples of how things are getting twisted. When Leisha mentioned that advocacy piece, I can tell you when I was at a conference last year, I sat in on two different conference meetings where they were talking about peer support that was Medicaid reimbursable and that was under these systems. And one of them, I kept hearing this woman talk about, oh, and the peer does this, and then the peer does the health record, and then the peer does all these things that didn't sound right to me. And I finally got her on the side and I questioned her a bunch. And she eventually said to me, after trying to explain it multiple times, honey, I think you've confused peer support and advocacy. So that's one example of where I come from when I hear this idea of forcing, running, jumping, getting on the train to make sure we catch up with this changing system. The other I can offer, I'm not big on labels and serious and persistent mental illness because, frankly, you know, that's what I got called until, this is a good strategy tip if you find yourself or someone you know in this situation. I was in Florida at the time when I was getting hospitalized, and the best strategy I had, and it was because I had some resources to get myself into a different place and not keep getting hospitalized, it was to move. And so I moved back to Massachusetts, and I really had to extract myself from that whole place where people knew me. But when you're trapped in it, it can be really hard to do that, and if you don't have the resources to get out. And this woman in this Pennsylvania presentation on Medicaid reimbursable peer work, she was referring to herself as SMI. So SMI, as a, you know, SMI or SMPI, of course, they stand for serious mental illness. And that is painful, that idea that these Medicaid reimbursable systems are so entrenched in the medical model that even the people you're supposed to be supporting to get out of that mode and go on with their life are starting to refer to themselves not only as mentally ill, but as the acronym for mental illness. So I just would really hope that you all, as if you're in this world, are going to keep looking at what does it really look like when we really get entrenched in these systems. So the last thing I'm going to offer is actually better explained in this handout that I have, but it's just another example of the assumptions that we make and that drive us to jump in and get involved sometimes with some of these services. And I hear all the time that people in Massachusetts right now need to do notes, even if they're in peer roles, because of the Medicaid funding. And so I would argue that doing notes on somebody is a real power differential, and it really pulls people out of peer roles and really cannot function in a peer-to-peer relationship. And they keep getting told they have to do that because of this Medicaid reimbursement. If DMH can qualify something as a rehab day through Medicaid, they get 50% of their money back. And so every provider is out there telling all these people in peer roles, you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this, except for one that's under the same exact funding stream. And what that one organization has discovered or figured out that everyone else seems to be missing is that only 25% of the days that the Department of Mental Health pays for are our days, are our rehab days. So this idea that every single 100% of the days need to be our days is just a complete myth, but it is driving people every day. And if we go back and realize it's only 25% of the days that DMH is funding that end up on average being qualified as our days, then we know that people in peer roles do not need to be doing notes. So I guess that's just really to say, ultimately, the whole bit of what I'm saying is to really question everything. I might hit a wall at some point and have to realize that I screwed up. Maybe I was completely naive, but so far not. And all I keep finding as I look under the layers is that we need to not go in this direction. Mass expansion is not worth losing the intent of what these peer roles are. So I'll leave it at that.